Okay, let's get started now. I'm Maurice Samuels from Yale University, and I welcome you to the fifth panel of this wonderful conference. This panel is Capitalism, Apartheid, and the Third World. I am going to follow the custom and introduce all three of our panelists right at the beginning. Our first speaker is Alexander Zedelmeyer. He's senior lecturer in modern history at Bangor University in Wales. He focuses on Central Europe and North America and works on the history of violence, issues of consumption, and social movements. His recent publications include an article entitled 1968 as a Catalyst of Consumer Society, and he has a book forthcoming from University of Michigan Press called Consumption and Violence, Radical Protest in Cold War West Germany. The title of his paper is Dirty Export Business with Chile, South Africa, Israel, Boycott Campaigns of the Radical Left in Cold War West Germany. Our second speaker is Tahila Sassoon. She's a PhD candidate in history at the University of California, Berkeley. Her research interests include the political and cultural history of humanitarianism. Her dissertation is provisionally titled Feed the World, Britain and the Practice of Famine Relief, 1883 to 1985. And she next year will be a Mellon Visiting Fellow at Pembroke College in Cambridge. The title of her paper is Boycotting Nestle, the Campaign Against Milk Formula, 1974 to 1984. Our third speaker is Simon Stevens. He's a PhD candidate in international and global history at Columbia University in New York. He received his BA and MPhil degrees from the University of Cambridge. He's currently completing his doctoral thesis entitled Strategies of Struggle, International Pressure, and the End of Apartheid, 1958 to 1994. And he's the author of a recent article in Diplomatic History entitled From the Viewpoint of a Southern Governor, the Carter Administration and Apartheid. And the title of his paper today is Bank of Apartheid, the Barclays Bank Boycott and the Anti-Apartheid Disinvestment Campaign in Britain, 1969 to 1986. Thank you.
The title-giving quote of my paper immediately gives rise to various comparative perspectives. Were the boycotts embraced by leftists in the 1980s in a tradition of earlier boycotts about which we've heard in the previous panel? Were the different targets picked, Chile, South Africa, Israel, were they on a level or was the difference? It gives rise to both synchronic and diachronic comparisons. It raises questions of legitimacy, of moral tenability, whether to boycott a certain regime vis-a-vis another. So first I should make transparent my definition of boycott with which I'm working. So for me, the term boycott describes politically coordinated consumer choices supposed to trigger economic consequences, critical discourse, and movement mobilization in order to discipline, delegitimize, or overcome what were seen as morally reprehensible regimes of provision. And the final term, regime of provision, is more than just a metaphor, but is meant as an analytical term to tackle not only the connection between consumption and production in a system of provision, but also the fact that systems of provision are tied up with power relations, with the relations of violence, and with far-reaching political questions about what is deemed legitimate, appropriate, ethical consumption. Okay, so let me now turn to Cold War with Germany. And the starting point there is really that against the backdrop of Nazi boycotts of shops owned by Jews during the 1930s, the protest form of boycott was largely dormant during the 1950s. When it appeared, especially in the early 1960s, it was mostly directed against East Germany, or occasionally against the cultural products of individuals associated with the Nazi past. This constellation led to two boycotts that triggered landmark cases of constitutional law. And that is a legal dimension which I would like to stress, of boycotts triggering rather far-reaching repositioning of the entire legal system. The first case is the director of the Hamburg government's press office, a man called Erich Lütt, calling for a boycott of Veit Harlan's first post-war War II film. Veit Harlan, whom many of you will know, the director of Jud Süß and other anti-Semitic movies during Nazi Germany, issued his first post-war film in 1950, and his government official basically issued a call to boycott the screening of this movie. It was initially a rather small-scale affair with a few students trying to picket movie theaters, but then police got involved. But what is interesting is the legal dimension, because the courts of lower instance immediately granted Veit Harlan an injunction against this call for a boycott, claiming artistic freedom of expression, and so the lower courts supported Harlan in claiming private damages from this person, Erich Lütt, for calling for a boycott. This then went all the way up to the Constitutional Court throughout the 1950s, with the issue going back and forth at the different levels of the legal ladder, until finally the German Constitutional Court clearly sided with Lütt explained that this form of boycott is clearly covered by freedom of expression, and that Lütt, also as a government official, was completely in his right expressing his distaste about the articulation of this particular director, and this was covered by the protection of the law. The second landmark case is, interestingly, originates with the large-scale publishing company Springer. The Springer publishing company, which will figure later in a completely different context, embraced boycott against a rather obscure communist weekly, a weekly magazine called Blinkfuhr, in 1961. And the reason for that was that the Blinkfuhr published the East German television program. So they printed, they had one page where you could find out what was on telly in East Germany. And that was to the distaste of the Springer conglomerate of publishers, and they immediately flexed their economic muscles and said, with those large-scale traders and distributors, we terminate our economic business if they continue to distribute the Blinkfuhr. And again, the lower courts immediately supported Springer by pointing to the Lütt law, freedom of expression. Again, this time through the 1960s, this went all the way up until the Constitutional Court in 1969, 8 years after the initial conflict, said no. The boycott coupled with economic pressure is illicit. The Springer can say as a private person, but he cannot uses oligopolistic or arguably monopolistic position on the market to basically silence small competitors. Ironically, by this time, when Blinkfuhr and the publisher got his right, the small weekly was bankrupt. And even more ironically, Springer journals had for a long time, since 1964, 65, themselves resumed publishing the East German television program because people wanted to know what was on channels number 4 and 5 on the buttons on the TV set. So, interestingly enough, so these legal decisions demarcate a zone of basically legitimate or legally condoned boycott somewhere between freedom of expression and illicit pressure leaning on economic power. And I think that is interesting, and I would like to come back to this. The social movements only embraced boycott coupled with direct action in the late 1960s in the context of protest against public transport fare. And again, I was reminded when we talked about bus boycotts, yes, in Germany as well, in the 1970s, a little known large-scale campaigns, most famously in Hanover, the so-called Red Spot, Rote Punkt Aktion, which completely paralyzes public transport, a consumer boycott protest against fare hikes, but then also in the boycott against Springer, against the publisher of tabloid newspaper. And in that context, the language and the discourse of violence immediately made its entry. I have one quote from the 27th of December 1967, when the Austrian-American writer Hans Haber published an entire page letter to Axel Springer, basically supporting him against his critics, and saying, quote, "Even in Berlin, where Springer was said to have the most monopolistic stand, I was not able to discover any Springer terror organization that would flog your papers, as implied by the boycotters, but rather terror organizations that use violence to prevent their sale and seek to intimidate the reading public with threats." So the notion of violence was there long before the real violence on the street with the assassination of Dutschke and the week-long protests over Easter 1968, let alone political violence of the 1970s was there. It was already there, in at least in thought. So, concerning the legal treatment of boycotts, the central bone of contention was whether they were to be seen as illicit or even criminal offenses, or rather as political articulations covered by constitutional basic rights, especially freedom of expression and freedom of assembly. This pertained to linguistic and intellectual speech acts, for example, in leaflets calling for a boycott, as well as to performative and physical articulations, for example, blockades. And most boycott campaigns indeed combined both aspects. A variety of boycott campaigns against multinational companies and also against entire countries only emerged from 1973 onwards. Against the apartheid regime in South Africa, in support of the Palestinians' anti-Zionist struggle, against coffee companies in solidarity with revolutionaries in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Nicaragua, against multinational companies such as Nestle, or feminist solidarity campaigns with low-wage workers of the textile manufacturer Adler in South Korea. And in many ways, these campaigns culminated in 1988 during the meeting of the International Monetary Fund and World Bank in West Germany, an interesting precursor to later critical movements of globalization, where the title-giving quote comes from. It is taken from a statement of responsibility issued by the unknown perpetrators who placed a small-scale incendiary device in a Berlin department store. They write, quote, "At a department store, the fire sprinkling system put out a fire caused by an incendiary device. An autonomous cell, Department Consumer Protection, claimed responsibility for the act. In an admission statement, they called the department store a guarantor of dirty import business with Chile, South Africa, Israel. So I introduced this wrongly. I'm quoting a newspaper that's again paraphrasing the statement of responsibility. So you already see this rather strange amalgamation. The three dots basically invite you to say, well, South Africa, Chile, Israel, and wherever else. And that is then followed by a call to boycott these countries. So the boycott and fair trade campaigns of the 1980s lent themselves to a quotidian and transnational mobilization of solidarity networks and served activists as a performative signifier of their commitment, especially in comparison with earlier anti-imperialist campaigns, which had been more clearly motivated by socialist or communist ideals. They mirrored the growing sense of individualism propagated by their contemporary neoliberalism. Boycott campaigns, especially anti-apartheid and anti-Nestle, were important steps in the popularization of moral economies via purchase decisions based on ethical criteria, preparing the way for a new type of consumer capitalism, in which the image of politically and ecologically responsible production became ever more important. That is, if you wish, the system-conforming side of boycott, of basically saying, well, let's diversify the market to allow for ethically clean products. However, boycott campaigns also sought, and perhaps more importantly, sought to call attention to the destruction and violence that went hand in hand with the production or marketing of consumer goods in faraway countries. Violence against objects emerged as a militant variation of this type of protest. An upper limit of the use of legitimate violence in terms of the forms of the violence employed and the nature of the damages inflicted was for the most part integrated into the planning and justification of such acts. However, that was, of course, hugely controversial, whether, well, you could knock over a crate of oranges, or whether you could, in fact, put a small-scale incendiary device. Well, that divides people. So politically motivated boycott was first embraced, and that is another important point that I would like to make. It was first embraced and staged by rather strong players in the political contest. So in the early part of the Cold War, the state, large corporations, sizable parts of the population, and that is before and antecedent to the extra-parliamentary opposition and the new social movement seizing the method to articulate and mobilize critical minority views. For example, the CIA-sponsored Kampfgruppe gegen Unmenschlichkeit, combat group against inhumanity, committed stink bomb and incendiary attacks against East German department stores much earlier than any arson attacks by left-wing protesters. Springer used boycott flanked by economic pressure against Blinkfuhr and the DDR long before the students boycotted Springer, as previously mentioned. Willy Brandt and the Confederation of German Trade Unions called for a boycott of the East German-run Berliner S-Bahn, the public transport, prior to the students protesting public transport fare increases. So that's something to keep in mind. Only a specific minority, and now I come to the final chapter, if you wish, of my talk, of German left-wing radicals were prepared to go so far as to put Israel on a level with South Africa and to subscribe to analogous calls to boycott Israeli products. When leftist activists embraced anti-Zionist boycotts, which for historical reasons and understandable ethical concerns was a particularly difficult field of political communication in Germany, their calculation usually backfired. They were very rarely successful in making this step. Among these groups were the revolutionary Zellen, the revolutionary cells, who used boycott and incendiary attacks against targets associated with Israel and West Germany. This focus was a move away, however, from large-scale terrorist attacks on the international stage following the public relations disaster the international wing of the revolutionary cells, closely allied to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, experienced with the Entebbe hijack in July 1976. The revolutionary cells admitted to 186 militant attacks against a variety of targets between 1973 and 1993. Less than 5% of these were directed against Israel. One of these, in 1978, the revolutionary cells attacked the Frankfurt-based company Agrexco, the largest importer of Israeli fruit in Europe, and no casualties, material damage to the building. And in the same year, there were cases when Israeli oranges were found to have been injected with mercury. Evidence suggests that radical European solidarity groups, perhaps the revolutionary cells themselves or similar Dutch groups, invented this form of protest. In 1979, another attack targeted the fruit importer and wholesale trade company Hamaico, again in Frankfurt. The demand was that companies withdraw Israeli produce and that anti-fascist, as they labeled themselves, activists provoke boycotts by injecting butyric acid into Zionist fruit. So that, of course, raises the question, well, are there, well, fruit are fruit. They are not Zionist. They are grapefruits in the first place. And you see the problem with that immediately. The revolutionary cells were early in taking up Israel as a target of their militant action and boycott campaigns, and the British Palestine Solidarity Campaign, for example, only embraced the Boycott Israeli Goods campaign in 1982, a few years later. In 1987, in the context of the First Intifada, squatters from Hamburg's... One minute, that's shocking. Okay, that means I need to cut the bit about the famous mural, which many of you will know, about Hamburg's Hafenstraße. So that's too bad timekeeping by my side. I apologize. I come to my conclusion. Point one of the conclusion. The struggle for human rights or iteration of an anti-Semitic tradition, as our program raised the question. Well, I'm reluctant to accept the binary perspective. Boycotting is a communicative technique of favoring and or discrediting particular interests that can be used by any political persuasion. Many boycott campaigns, especially those directed against Israel, were perceived as inappropriate or tasteless, giving immediate rise to comparisons with Nazi boycott campaigns. Some anti-Zionist activists have clearly displayed a rather simplistic historical understanding of National Socialism, venturing into discursive territory with anti-Semitic connotations. But I would argue there's still an important difference to Nazi stormtroopers. Left-wing boycotters symbolically attacked goods of Israeli origin from a position of relative weakness, motivated by ideas of international solidarity. But they did not, as a rule, physically attack Jewish vendors, leaning on the inhuman abuse of state-sponsored or paramilitary violence and a pervasive eliminatory ideology. My second point of conclusion tackles the question, were these anti-Zionist or anti-Israeli boycotts fundamentally different from other boycotts in Cold War West Germany? Well, freely adapted from a famous quip usually attributed to Isaiah Berlin, anti-Israeli boycotts were just like other boycotts, only more so. On balance, they were not more prominent, I think, than the many other boycott scenarios that the radical left embraced, just more intense. Let me explain this, my third point of conclusion. An essential part of the communicative strategy of boycotting is to bridge distance, both spatially and historically, and to connect seemingly far-removed political struggles. This produces a discursive amalgamation. Specific forms of protest or boycott assumed to be legitimate are justified with reference to past or present violence deemed to be illegitimate. given the unique historical past of the Holocaust and the Arab-Israeli conflict, there was simply more explosive matter from both sides of the debate that went into this amalgamation. Anti-Semitic statements or accusations of anti-Semitism may be the outcome of this process, but among the vast majority of radical left-wing boycott activists, I would argue anti-Semitism was not a precondition, let alone a motivation of their activism. Another important difference compared to the self-avowed and pervasive anti-Semitism of the Nazis, and not to forget the neo-Nazis, but an outcome of the political debate. Thank you.